We meet at a very unusual time for lots of reasons. It has been a somber and a stunning week, and one in which many of the normal indices of politics and media comment and advocacy have sort of been rearranged in unusual ways. I was at a meeting on Tuesday with Brent Bozell, who runs a group called the Media Research Center, and who's the main activity of which is criticizing the liberal media. And Brent had, in the spirit of bipartisanship and comity and unity that has prevailed in the wake of the disaster of September 11th, sort of declared a moratorium on criticizing the media. He was said they were doing a pretty good job and so forth. And I think that to some extent I would agree with that. On the other hand, I said to him, I said, there are always aspects of the media that will obtrude themselves, and the superficiality that Klaus was referring to is one of these. And I remember watching in our local coverage on Wednesday or Thursday, these TV personalities were trying to give the local angle on it, and they kept coming back over and over again to the fact that the statement that everything has now changed, that life in America will never be the same again, and that Americans must be ready for enormous transformations in their way of life. And this was stated many times and in many ways. And then this news anchor said, for example, we've just received in the newsroom an order from Secretary of Transportation Norman Mineta that there will be no more curbside check-in. And I asked myself, are we willing to let that go so easily? No more curbside check-in. Think about that. So the media, they can't be counted on. There you go. The superficiality is always there. This meeting is one that I was particularly interested in attending because of its focus on the South. Many people who know me think of me as a native of the Midwest because I spent many years in Indiana, but I'm a Southerner. I was born in Texas and I lived in this state, and my mother's from Mississippi and so on. And I'm a great fan of the South, and it's sometimes hard to explain the South to people from other regions. And one of my favorite efforts to encapsulate the nature of the South was a statement by a friend of mine from Alabama, who said, in Alabama, alcohol, tobacco, and firearms is not a bureau, but a way of life. And that does characterize a lot of the South and some other parts of the country as well. Now, one of the things that has happened in this turbulent week was the change in my own assignment. I was prepared to come here and deliver a tribute, a very well-deserved tribute, to Vic Milione. Bill Campbell called me on, what was it, Bill? Tuesday, Wednesday this week, and informed me that that was no longer my assignment, but I am now to deliver a tribute to John Ryan. And I asked Bill, I said, can I take the tribute to Vic Milione, cross out Vic's name and put it, he said, no, you cannot do that. You must prepare a totally separate tribute to John Ryan. So I have done that. John was a son of Indiana, but I think it is appropriate that this commemoration occur in this at this venue, because there are many affinities, as I found living in Indiana for 16 years, between the South and the great Hoosier State. And a couple of these are, let me give you two vignettes, one from the South and one from Indiana, to sort of suggest the nature of this affinity. One of my favorite stories, and I have confirmed that it is a true story, occurred back in the late 60s when Lester Maddox was the governor of Georgia. And at that time, a riot broke out at the state prison in Georgia, and there's much concern about this, and the media finally tracked Governor Maddox down at some crossroads in Georgia and confronted him and questioned him about this problem and asked him, what is going on in the state prison and what should we do about it? And Maddox's answer was, we need a better class of inmates. And I often think of that story and I look at the U.S. Congress, but that's another matter. The other vignette, which is also true, and this was one in which I was personally involved, and I want to suggest the sort of environment in which Indiana politics for many years has been conducted, in which John Ryan thrived and was very, very active for many years. This involved a member of the Indiana State Legislature, known, I think, to some in this room, I see some other Hoosiers out here, who had been elected, who was a tool and die maker on the south side of Indianapolis, who was an insurgent Republican conservative slate that beat the machine, and he got elected to the state legislature, but he didn't know very much about the issues in the legislature, and he took to calling me, shows how naive he was. He thought I knew something about it, and calling me, I was then the editor of the paper, almost every night, and asking me about things that were impending in the legislature. And my wife, as soon as I won't give his name, I give him a nom de guerre, Vernon Wormer, I'll call him Vernon Wormer, would call, and my wife would say, it's a Vernon Wormer. And so he would always have some question about something in the legislature. And this one night he called up, and he said, Stan, have you ever heard of something called the National Endowment for the Human Itties? And I thought about that for a minute. I said, human itties. Humanities? Oh, yeah, whatever. He said, it's some kind of federal thing, and they're trying to bring it down to Indiana University, and I don't like the sound of it. And I said, I don't either. Federal, we don't want it here. So he said, well, we're having a hearing on this on Thursday, and I want to find out about this thing. It was a hearing with the presidents of all the four major state universities in Indiana, IU, Purdue, Indiana State, and Ball State. And so I said, okay, Vernon, you can go after him. And I said, remember, humanities. So I kind of forget about this, and then I pick up the Sunday paper, and Bill Campbell and Fred Mann and Tim Wheeler and some others here remember, there was a column in the Star every Sunday called Behind Closed Doors, which was written actually by a guy named Bob Mooney, who was the main political reporter for the Star. But it was all this sort of gossipy stuff about things that had happened in the legislature. And I opened it up, I'm sitting here Sunday morning, and here's this headline. It says, quote, spelled out phonetically, what's this here human itties? And the story said, the presidents of all four state universities were stunned Thursday morning by an onslaught from State Representative Vernon Wormer, who demanded to know, what's this here, human itties? And I read that, and I thought of all these four university presidents sitting there beneath the steely gaze of State Representative Vernon Wormer, knowing that he was on the budget committee, that their budgets depended on his whim. And I thought to myself, Yes. This is the way it should be. This is America. Now, I tell you that story, one of my favorite vignettes from my years in Indiana, because that is the environment in which our friend John Ryan, who was a Harvard graduate, mind you, was quite comfortable. John was a person of many talents and many abilities and facets to his activity, and you would have never known in his functioning in the state politics of Indiana that he had attended Harvard University, which I think is something that was to his credit that he concealed that. And he also had many other facets to his personality that showed his versatility. He was a businessman and a very successful one, and a politician in Indiana state politics, but he was also an intellectual. He understood the fundamentals that Klaus was referring to. He was a president of this society. He was a man of considerable means, wealth. He had a Bentley in his garage out on the north side of Indianapolis, but you would have never have known that. He would come to work in khakis, and he drove a VW bus down to his office in the state house. And the only time that his wealth ever came into his public persona involved another vignette, which was very, very Indiana. There was a visiting fireman who came to the state back in the early 70s. We were having a big fight then with the Legal Services Organization out of Washington, which was strictly a machine for promoting left-wing causes, and they were very much involved in doing that in Indianapolis. And we managed to, through various devices, I forget how, to get the funding from the Legal Services Organization transferred over to the Bar Association, which was a much then in Indiana was a very conservative institution. And there was a visiting person who came to Indiana at that time while this was going on and read about all this controversy of taking the money away from the Legal Services Organization and giving it to the Bar Association. And John was there and some others, and we were explaining this to this person, and he was indignant because the money was being taken away from this poverty agency to be given to the Bar Association. He said, well, what are they going to do with it? So John and I explained to him that the money, the federal money that had been formerly used to help the poverty program, would be used to advise people of means about tax shelters and municipal bonds and other things that would have some legal implication. And this made the person even more indignant. And he said, well, whose idea was that? And we said, well, it was actually lobbied through the legislature by the Indiana Council of Rich People. And John here is the president of that. And so John, in that one instance, was willing to own up to the fact that he was wealthy. And that was another title that he bore with great humility throughout his career, President, Indiana Council of Rich People. John, besides these anecdotes, was a moving spirit of conservatism in Indiana and indeed in the nation. And Indiana has a long heritage as a bastion of conservatism, and we think of names like Bill Jenner, Dan Quayle, Pierre Goodrich, Al Campbell, and we think of people who have been connected with the society. Don Lipset, Bill Campbell, the secretaries of this society from the beginning have been from Indiana. And John was of that lineage and of that caliber. He was very active in the early days of the Goldwater movement. He was a charter member of what we like to call the Indiana Iron Guard, which was a group of conservatives who met monthly there. He was really the intellectual captain of the gubernatorial campaign of Ed Whitcomb, who did become the governor there. John was an early backer of Ronald Reagan, and the story continues. He then went to Washington, where he served as a member and then later as chairman of the Postal Rate Commission. And in all of these capacities, John fought, and fought effectively, for cutting taxes, deregulation, free enterprise, limited government, all the things that we have talked about for so many years in this society. John was a true believer in free enterprise, and there was an aphorism I once heard, I thought, applied to John, that he thought that the invisible hand was an intolerable interference with the free market. He was a free marketeer. And many other things that one might say about that. As we all know, this has been a week for celebrating heroes and talking about heroism and heroes. And John was a hero in every sense of the word. One of the other things about him that you would never have known was that he was a decorated combat veteran of World War II, Bronze Star. I never heard him say a word about it. You would not have known that to talk to him. He was a military hero, but he was in addition a hero of our movement. He never wavered in his commitment, never shrank from any battle, never compromised a precept. A motto that was attributed to a famous fighting general that I think of when I think of John was, "Ride to the sound of the cannon." That's what John did. He rode to the sound of the cannon, and that could well have been his slogan. May we who remain to carry on the fight adopt that as our motto also. Thank you very much.